Death and disease are the devastating reality of our human experience. And ever since Adam's disobedience in the Garden of Eden, sin entered the world, bringing, of course, disease and its terminal condition of death. And we know that from Romans chapter 5. But if you think of the suffering that we experience, the physical suffering we experience because of disease, Americans spend an average of $11,000 each year per person on health care, making it a multi-billion dollar industry in our country. But alas, it doesn't necessarily help, because we are still diseased and sick and dying, and none of us is immune from that reality, and not a week goes by when one of our family or friends isn't suffering from some sickness. And so we think of the suffering of disease, then we think of the fear that we experience because of death. We don't like to think about death, and so we don't talk about death. When we do talk about death, we talk about death in code language. Our code language, perhaps, when we are trying to be sensitive, we say things like, "Well, I'm sorry for your loss." Or if we are attempting some sarcastic humor, we say, "So-and-so kicked the bucket," or "They bit the dust." And none of us can escape it if not a week goes by when we don't hear of some loved one or some friend or associate who is confronted by death and facing death in some way. I remember that after the passing of both of my parents, I had a new consciousness of my own mortality. And you're well aware of my father dying when he was 59 and my mom dying when she was only 62. And I was concerned for the care of my own family in the event of my own demise. And so I did the responsible thing, and I determined that I needed some additional life insurance. And so I did some research online for various life insurance companies, and I placed a call to one life insurance company to purchase some more life insurance. And, of course, the agent that was helping me asked me of my age and such and a number of different questions, and then asked me if either of my parents had been diagnosed with cancer before the age of 65. And I said, "Well, yes." And the agent asked, "Well, which one?" I said, "Well, both of them." Then the agent asked if either of my parents had died of cancer before age 65, and I said, "Well, yes." And he said, "Well, which one?" And I said, "Well, both of them." And the agent said, "Well, I'm sorry, you'll have to talk to my supervisor," right? And so they sent me up the line to a special department, a high-risk department. You see, because both of my parents had passed away of cancer before age 65, evidently I'm high-risk. And evidently the actuaries or whoever does the algorithms to figure out how they can make money off my life insurance policy had figured out that I was a high-risk candidate for insurance. And so I'm confronted with my own mortality in the face of disease and in the face of death. What do we do? Where do we turn? Of course, the answer is Jesus. Jesus healed disease. And Jesus raised the dead. In fact, when the disciples of John the Baptist asked him, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" they asked of Jesus. Jesus answered and said, "Go, tell John the things that you have seen and heard. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." And so Jesus was the answer to disease and death, of course, authenticating his messiahship. But perhaps most familiar to us is the occasion in John chapter 11 when Mary and Martha sent word to Jesus that their brother Lazarus was sick. And evidently some disease was ravaging Lazarus' body, and his sickness was more than the common cold. Within hours he was dead, and Jesus tarried for 2 days before coming, and by the time he reached Bethany in Judea, Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. It was then that Jesus told Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live, and whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this, Martha and Mary and 21st century Christian?" And so we need to have faith in the face of disease and death. The gospel narrative here, now you have Mark chapter 5 open before you. Verses 21 through 43 can be easily divided into three different scenes that demonstrate the power of God through Jesus Christ and teach us about faith in the face of disease and death. After Jesus' confrontation with the demoniac in the land of Gadara, the country of the Gadarenes, in the early verses of Mark 5, Jesus returned back across the sea from the east to the west, presumably to some place near his hometown of Capernaum. We pick up in verse 21 where the Bible tells us that a great multitude gathered to Jesus. Mark 5:21. Now when Jesus crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed, and she will live." So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. I haven't printed notes for you, but I do have a brief outline reflecting the three scenes in this narrative. Number one, Jesus and the man. Jesus and the man, an introduction. Simply an introduction. It's a bit unusual for Mark to use specific or proper names. Mark most often simply says, "A man," as he did with the maniac of Gadara in chapter 5, verse 2. But in this case, Mark names the man. His name was Jairus. But it wasn't just any man named Jairus. It was Jairus, the ruler, a ruler of the synagogue. Now, a ruler of the synagogue was not a professionally trained scribe or a professionally trained rabbi in the synagogue, but he was rather a layman who had been appointed by the community to be a leader in the synagogue. And a ruler of the synagogue would coordinate the public reading of the scriptures and the prayers at their meetings, and the ruler of the synagogue would care for the building's security and its maintenance. And we might liken one of the rulers of the synagogue to some of you who volunteer in this place and serve in this place in so many capacities here at Fourth Baptist Church that you really ought to be on the payroll, right? You spend hours and hours here coordinating and serving and performing your ministry here. So many responsibilities to make all that happens happen around here. And that's the case for Jairus, one of the rulers. Now, normally a synagogue would have a single ruler. But sometimes there would be two or more rulers, as is suggested in verse 22 there. He was one of the rulers. And so at a minimum, Jairus was part of a small group, a small number of leaders who were well known for their service and their role of leadership in the synagogue. It's probable that Jairus was well respected outside the synagogue as well. In fact, it's probable that Jairus had such a good reputation among the community outside the synagogue, which is what gave him his role of ruler within the synagogue, because both sacred and civil matters would take place and be addressed in the synagogue. Was he successful? Probably. Was he wealthy? Probably. Was he well known? Most definitely. And so Mark didn't need to introduce Jairus in any other way other than identifying his name as one of the rulers in the synagogue. I also don't think that Jairus needed to introduce himself to Jesus, because Jesus would have had numerous interactions with Jairus, as Jesus was often teaching in the synagogue. In fact, I think perhaps that maybe even Jesus and Jairus had numerous confrontations because of Jesus' teaching in the synagogue. We know that Jesus created controversy with his teaching in the synagogue there in Capernaum, beginning in Mark chapter 1, verses 21 and 22. And we can assume that Jairus, being one of the rulers of the synagogue, had to deal with the controversy that Jesus created, and probably was caught in the crossfire between the people and Jesus, between the people and the religious establishment, and Jesus and the religious establishment. And perhaps some even complained to Jairus, "What should we do with this man Jesus? Why do you give him a platform and opportunity to teach?" And so if you'll allow some sanctified speculation this evening, I have a theory. And my theory is that early in Mark's gospel, we are told that Jesus, repeatedly told that Jesus went into the synagogues and he taught. chapter 1, verse 21, chapter 1, verse 39, chapter 3, verse 1. However, in time, Jesus took his teaching outside of the synagogue. Jesus began teaching in the mountains. Jesus began teaching by the sea. And we assume that Jesus took his teaching outside of the synagogues because the crowds became too great, too large. There were too many people to fit inside the synagogue, and I think that's probably true. However, I wonder if Jairus at some point didn't pull Jesus aside and say, "Listen, your teaching is causing problems with the scribes and the Pharisees. And I'm going to have to ask you to take your teaching outside. If you would like to teach here in the synagogue, this is what you should say. But if you want the liberty to say your piece, you're going to have to find a different place to do your teaching." And I wonder if Jesus and Jairus didn't have that conversation, perhaps that altercation or that confrontation. And I wonder if Mark didn't feel compelled to name Jairus as Jairus, one of the rulers of the synagogue, because it was publicly understood that Jairus and Jesus were incompatible because of Jesus' teaching. And so my point is, I don't think Jairus needed much of an introduction other than to say, "Jairus, one of the rulers of the synagogue." Everyone knew who he was. But Mark names him because of his significance and the desperation that Jairus is demonstrating here now in coming to Jesus. Why? Because Jairus' daughter was sick and dying. And folks, there is nothing as grave as disease that leads to death. And when a loved one's life is on the line, you are motivated to do whatever it takes for help and for healing. I remember on a few different occasions when we had to rush one of our children to the ER because they were sick or injured. And in haste, we didn't care really what we looked like, right? We just out the door as quick as you can, in the car as quick as you can, because there's a sense of urgency to get your child to the ER. Perhaps you remember times when you've received a call from a family member or a friend who's taken a turn for the worse, and any petty differences that you have between that one and the other are just melted away because their condition is grave. And so that's Jairus. He comes to Jesus. In verse 24, the Bible tells us that Jesus went with Jairus right away, and others followed Jairus or Jesus. They thronged them as they went. But we continue reading into verse 25. The matter of Jairus and his daughter is interrupted. Look at verse 25. "Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She spent all..." No, let me stop here. Whatever happened to Jairus and his daughter? It's as if the narrative is just rudely interrupted. And so where I would call number one, Jesus and the man, an introduction, I would call, beginning in verse 25, number two, Jesus and the woman, an interruption. There's an introduction, there's an interruption, beginning in verse 25. "Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, 'If only I may touch his clothes, I may be made well.' Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, 'Who touched my clothes?' But his disciples said to him, 'You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, "Who touched me?" And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction.'" The event with Jesus and Jairus is interrupted by another individual in the crowd. And this case, it was not a he, but it was a she, and she is unnamed. Nevertheless, it appears that perhaps the public would have known her and understood her condition. Verses 24 and 25 or 25 and 26 there tell us that she had suffered for 12 years in spite of many physicians who had tried to treat her at great expense. And unfortunately, she actually grew worse and worse, and her condition rendered her ceremonially unclean according to Leviticus 15, 19 to 27, really making her an outcast in society. So people would have simply known her as that lady. But while Jairus was a man of high reputation, a ruler in the synagogue, this one woman was a woman of low reputation, perhaps even barred from the synagogue. But both were equally desperate because of disease that could lead to death. And both of them acted in faith in the face of disease and death. And in verse 27 and 28, if you look there, the woman acted upon her belief, as misguided as her belief was. Let's just acknowledge that. She believed that if she could touch Jesus' garment, she would be made well. There was a common superstition in the ancient world that some had the power to bless those who touched them. And evidently there was a time when people would make every effort to touch Alexander the Great in hopes of gaining some benefit from his aura or from his power. And even today, crowds of people will make every effort to get close to a celebrity at a ball game or a musician at a concert, or to get a glimpse or just to simply reach out and touch that superstar. And so that superstition isn't necessarily something ancient, but it's also something that continues to this day. Mark makes no judgment about the lady's superstition. He simply reports on the consequences of that interruption in verses 29 and 30. Immediately she was healed of her affliction in verse 29, and immediately Jesus knew that someone had touched his clothing in verse number 30. Of course, Jesus' disciples dismissed the matter, right, as incidental in verse 31. Of course, all the people who are crowding Jesus, pressing Jesus, the language used is thronging Jesus. But a woman stepped forward to identify herself in verse 33, and she, now catch this, I'm going to suggest she becomes a model of faith for Jairus. You see, Jairus has not forgotten about his daughter, his little girl, but I think Jairus was perhaps caught up in the interruption and all of the activity there. There's no doubt that Jairus is watching this closely. And if you'll allow me some more sanctified speculation, I wonder if Jairus had not also have had a confrontation with this woman. And perhaps Jairus had forbid her from being in the synagogue because of her condition. Jairus, after all, was one who would have to either welcome or dismiss those who weren't permitted to be part of the assembly at the synagogue. And so Jairus watches this woman, and he sees the miracle that takes place, and his attention is captured by this interruption. And I think that as Jairus witnessed this miracle, I believe that Jairus' faith was buoyed. It was strengthened. His hope was elevated. If Jesus could help this woman, who for 12 years has had this condition, then certainly Jesus can help my daughter. We're on the way to help my daughter. This is going to be so good. But in verse 35... the interruption was interrupted as those from Jairus' house came to report that it was too late. Verse 35, while he was still speaking, that is Jesus, to the woman, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" This brings things to a screeching halt, a crashing low. It reminds me again of Mary and Martha in John chapter 11. They had sent for Jesus, "Come, your friend Lazarus, our brother, is sick. Jesus, please come." But Jesus came too late, and their loved one had already died. In fact, he had been buried for 4 days. Folks, do you think it's unreasonable to suggest that the interruption of the woman, beginning in verse 25 through verse 34, that interruption delayed Jesus enough to prevent Jesus from reaching Jairus' home in time to heal the sick girl? Is it unreasonable to conclude, as you read the narrative, that the woman's healing cost the little girl her life. From our human perspective, there's no other way to think about that. And perhaps there have been times in your lives when you have sensed an interruption or a delay in your plans that have had devastating consequences. And perhaps you've argued with the Lord saying, God, if you would have sooner, or if you would have answered when I first asked, God, because of your delay, my daughter is dead. Lord, because you turned aside to help that woman, my daughter is dead. Look at verse 36. As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not be afraid, only believe. Now, if we were to read this in the Greek language, it could be translated, keep believing. Jairus, keep believing. You came to me in faith at the first, asking me to come heal your daughter. Some circumstances have changed. Keep believing. Jairus had the faith to come to Jesus when she was sick. Jairus' faith was buoyed by the miracle he witnessed with the woman. His faith was strengthened by the Jesus healing of the woman. But now it's too late for anything to be done for his daughter. What is there to believe? Keep believing. Continue believing. As you believed that I could heal her disease, keep believing that I can raise her from the dead. Wow, that's a quantum leap. And so Jesus and his inner circle of three disciples proceeded to Jairus' home, verse 37. Verse 37, and he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping. And they ridiculed him. But when he had put them outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. I suppose it was almost insulting for Jesus to say, the child's not dead. That was rude. That was crude to say that she's only sleeping. But the people weren't insulted by that, but rather they ridiculed him as foolish, as not knowing what he's talking about. You see, the ancients were able to recognize the difference between life and death. They could measure the vital signs just as we do as moderns. They ridiculed Jesus. He didn't know what he was talking about, or he was in denial. Verse 41, then he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kuma, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, rise. Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. But he commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and he said that something should be given to her to eat. I would call this Jesus and the girl an intervention. There was Jesus and the man, an introduction, Jairus, ruler of the synagogue. There was Jesus and the woman was an interruption. And now Jesus and the girl, an intervention. And folks, when you think about the significance of this miracle, Jesus raised a girl back to life. Walking on the water, feeding the 5,000, raising the dead. Just a couple observations and principles for you to take home as we read this narrative. I would suggest two things for you this evening. First, no matter who you are, you need Jesus. If you're Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, if you're the unnamed woman with chronic illness, If you're a little girl, you need Jesus. On the one hand, the woman who is ceremonially unclean and beyond the help of conventional science or medicine. On the other hand, there was the man who was the leader of society with a daughter who was sick and then died in spite of her father's resources. But both of them, all of us, are desperate because we are diseased and dying as a consequence of the fall and our own sin nature. All of us desperately need what only Jesus can give. You can take all the vitamins in the world. You can go to all the doctors in the world. You can spend all the money in the world. But alas, Jesus is the only hope that you have. No matter who you are, you need Jesus. Number two, no matter how imperfect your faith, it is always Jesus who works the miracle. So think with me briefly about the faith of the man Jairus. The man's faith was selfish. Jairus didn't come to Jesus out of love for Jesus, but out of love for himself and his daughter. It's probable that Jairus had an aversion to Jesus because of Jesus' controversial teaching in his synagogue there at Capernaum. But many times, people are so desperate in their circumstances, they turn to Jesus with imperfect faith. And I submit to you that that's okay. Later in Mark chapter 9, there was a gentleman who had a demon-possessed son, and he said, "Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief." And so Jairus had selfish faith. How about the woman? The woman's faith was misinformed. Misinformed faith. The woman came to Jesus out of superstition that if she could touch his robe, she would be healed. We would be critical of her approach. Her approach was not the right approach. She didn't believe as she ought to. It was misinformed. But I would submit again, it's not so much her faith, it's Jesus who works the miracle. So whether Jairus or the woman, how about the child? I would say the girl's faith was ignorant. I doubt that she could have explained the deity of Christ or the triunity of God. However, I wonder if in her delirious fever, she begged her dad to go and get Jesus to help her because no one else could help her. I don't know. That's just my speculation. Perhaps she never had that conversation with her father, Jairus, and perhaps Jairus went on his own, but now she's dead. What of the faith of the little girl? She had no faith. How do dead people express faith? You see, it wasn't her faith, but it was, in fact, the miraculous, omnipotent power of Jesus Christ. So here's the thing, folks. Faith in the face of disease and death. Our faith may be imperfect faith, and we might have poor form in our faith. But yet, in spite of that, our faltering faith, Jesus can work a miracle, and Jesus can meet a need. It doesn't matter where you're at in your current condition. Call upon Jesus. Cast your care upon Jesus. Say, "Lord, I believe. Help thou my unbelief." And trust the Lord to work the miracle. Now, of course, Jesus didn't heal everyone in his public ministry. And certainly, God hasn't promised to cure or to spare everyone who asks for healing. However, we always go to him in faith, believing that if it is his will, he can and he will heal. Lord, I come to you believing that if it is your will, that you will heal, that you will spare, but if not, I'll continue to trust that your way is perfect. Let's pray. Dear God, we confess that our faith is imperfect. Lord, sometimes we find ourselves so desperate, we're driven by motives of self-preservation or survival. Lord, we come to you for many different reasons. I pray that you would help our unbelief. And Lord, may our faith not be in our own faith, but rather in you, the one who chooses to restore health or life as you see fit. Lord, I pray that our faith would find our rest in you, for I pray this in Jesus' name.